Well, thank you for joining us again today for this podcast. We're thrilled to have with us Russell James. Russell's got a lot of initials behind his name, but the one I think would best fit him would be Friend. He's just a good man, a friend to so many people, and someone that I look up to and respect and appreciate his academic skills and talents and interest. A lot of people are not really this interested in the academic side of this. And so, Russell, I want to personally thank you for joining us on the call. The calls we've had, the podcast with icons in our industry, obviously you're one of them. They have been fascinating. We have really enjoyed them. And so we really appreciate you taking time to do this today.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to listening to them myself.
Oh, that'd be great. Let me ask you a couple pretty simple questions, which may not be simple to answer. But what are the most important lesson or lessons you've learned in your career, and how have they made a difference?
Well, I guess let me start out with the fact that since I'm a professor who has tenure, I get to tell people things they don't want to hear. And one of the things that people really don't want to hear but is really important is if you're interested in raising money through gifts and wills or other revocable estate planning gifts, you got to go see old people. Now, I know that this makes the work harder, but look, I do lots of research on this, and you just can't get around it. Let me give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
There was a national sample of Australian probate records. 76% of the charitable dollars came from wills signed in the 80s, 90s, and older. Here in the United States, from our most recent data from 95 from estate tax returns shows that 77% of charitable dollars comes from those in their 80s and older. It's probably over 80% now with increased longevity. Now, you combine with that another piece of information, which is the charitable component in estate plans becomes highly fluid at the end of life. For example, in a major U.S. study, we found that the majority of charitable dollars came from estate plans that at some point within the last 2 to 5 years prior to death had no charitable component. And what we see over a long period of time, year after year after year, is that the 10-year retention rate for a charitable component in an estate plan is 55%. So we've got a lot of fluidity, especially at the end of life. I know that makes life harder for people when I'm saying go see old people, but fundamentally that is the period in life when these decisions are being made. Because when it comes to gifts and wills, it's a little bit like the old idea that the score doesn't count until the clock runs out. Mm-hmm. And we've got to understand that people change their mind. They don't become cognitively fossilized in their 80s and 90s. And we've got to stay connected with those folks.
Oh, absolutely. That's great advice. When you think about your research, Russell, has much changed in the years you've been doing the various challenges and topics?
You know, I think the thing that has changed more is that we have more data. We have more information now than we did a few decades ago. And most of the findings that we have are not a shock, but to be able to quantify them and prove them now is different. Just to give you an example, if you're interested in raising charitable gifts from gifts and wills or estate plans, you've got to deal with the donor's family obligations. Now, that comes up in the data because the number one predictor of leaving a gift and how much that gift is going to be is actually childlessness. That's yep. far more important than anything else. And if you're working with clients who are not childless, what we found in experiments is that one of the best approaches to dealing with that conflict with the family is to suggest gifts in honor of family members memorial gifts.
You know, that's been our experience, too. We find that it changes the conversation when you talk in terms of two things, gifts of appreciated assets, but more than anything else, do you want to honor or memorialize someone?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we see that in Yeah, we see that in experiments when we sort of do them in the lab, same results that we get. And by the way, when you're making those kinds of suggestions, especially if it's for a memorial gift, one of the things that we found is that people are really attracted to anything that has a sense of permanence, like a permanent endowed scholarship or something that adds that permanence to the memorial or gift in honor of a family member.
Yeah. You know, you probably have not made many mistakes in your career. You'd be one of those rare individuals. A lot of us have. In fact, Casey says we built a great company on all of Eddie's mistakes. But what mistakes have you made or mistake have you made that you've really learned a great lesson from?
You know, I'd say probably this is a problem that I had when I was director of planned giving, assistant director first, right out of law school, and one that I have gone to the extreme opposite side now. And that is the idea of using what I call family words rather than formal words. You know, just out of law school, my tendency was to want to use all of our insider terminology. And what I've had to learn is that that's not what motivates donors. And so we actually have to go through a translational process where we convert all of this technical, tax, and legal information that we have into stories. Now, this actually can be a problem in the industry, and let me be a little bit obnoxious here by saying that we get into this problem because there are groups of consultants who sell to insiders, that is, people who are experts, and oftentimes they promote materials that use insider language because they're selling to insiders, which is the fundraisers. But fundraisers are not selling to insiders, and so it's important when we're talking with donors that we don't use that technical insider language, that we use the simple family words and simple stories to communicate ideas.
You know, it reminds you of that old expression, keep it simple, silly, instead of stupid, keep it silly. You know, we get too carried away, don't we, and make it harder than it has to be. What if you were sitting down with someone who is a brand new major gift officer, what's the one bit of advice you would give them?
So the one bit of advice I would give them that we now have massive empirical evidence for is this: gifts of assets are more valuable than gifts from disposable income. In other words, if you can get a donor to give you that same $10,000 gift out of appreciated stock, which, by the way, is much more advantageous for them rather than just as a checkbook gift, you have changed the mindset of that donor, and it affects future fundraising because all of a sudden they've done something different. They've made a contribution out of their wealth rather than out of their pocket change. We actually see this same result takes place after people place a charity into a will. Their subsequent giving goes up substantially, almost doubles on average. And I think it has to do with this idea that people start thinking about philanthropy, not in the context of their disposable income, but in the context of their wealth. And what we've seen now from actually millions of nonprofit tax returns is that organizations that are successful at raising those kinds of gifts, we can predict the next 2, 3, 5, 8 years will be more and more and more successful in their fundraising.
Oh, it's so true, isn't it? Russell, listen, I really appreciate what you've done over the years. I'm excited about what you're doing in the future. You have anything plan that you're willing to share?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the big concepts that we're working on right now, and this is really for major gift officers as well as fundraisers in other areas, is to understand this single sentence. I've tried to sort of summarize everything we know from psychology and neuroimaging and economics about how do we raise big gifts, and it really comes down to this one sentence. And that sentence is, advance the donor's hero story. If we understand the donor's story and understand how to make that a hero story through a gift, we can motivate transformational giving. Now, that requires knowing more about your donors and what's important to them and their story. But if you understand that what we are offering them is that opportunity for a noble impact or a heroic story, you begin to unlock why major gifts can be so powerful, not just for the organizations, but for the donors themselves.
That will never happen unless we get out and have conversations with donors. We have to be donor-centered.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Russell, you're the best. I really appreciate you taking time today to share your insights and wisdom and knowledge with so many of our listeners. And we truly appreciate all that you've done for our industry. You've really made an impact. You're one of those icons.
Thank you, sir. Thanks so much. I appreciate you having me.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to you joining us again on the next podcast. Until then, let us know if you have a topic you'd like for us to cover. Have a good day. Thanks, Russell.